Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And back in 2016, a couple was visiting parents in Hope Ranch. And somebody said to me, you know, you ought to have Colin Finley on the program because he is one of the world's foremost documentary photographers and filmmaker. And I thought, well, I can't miss this opportunity. And we had a really interesting conversation. Well, Colin emailed me and he was interested to know what happened to that recording. And I said, I think somebody's got it because it was one of my favorites. And so we reconnected and I thought, what a perfect opportunity to get caught back up with Colin Finley. And let me just introduce a little bit. We had a wonderful time talking about Colin, John and I last night because of all his achievements. I got to say that his bio that he sent me has one phrase at the very end of the bio that I'm going to move to the top of my bio, which is for his dedication to humanity. He was knighted in 2009. And I'm going to move that to the top, because we don't have a lot of knights on the program. Richard, have we ever? Oh, maybe Santi. Santi's a knight of the Italian Republic, isn't he? Yeah. Santi's the other.
Oh, Santi, another knight. I believe, yeah.
Yeah, Santi Vasali. So is he, he's a knight of the Italian.
I think you're right, yeah.
And Colin is here, also a knight. Colin, what was that like?
It was... you know, truly humbling. You know, I feel that my work has been so much largely about my service to humanity and what I've put out there emotionally into this world to create some of the imagery that I have. Actually getting a little welled up thinking about it, but being asked to take a knee, you know, and then the sword goes on either side of your shoulder and it's, you know, rise of night.
That must be incredible. Incredible.
So, yeah, it was very powerful to be acknowledged in that space.
May I ask who knighted you?
What I do is I fall under Malta. So I'm a knight of Malta, and that was knighted by Sir Edward Artis, who is the commander of the of that division of the knighthood.
So that Knights of Malta, the Knights of Malta go back so far. It's funny because I think, was it Caravaggio who got in trouble because he was fighting with one of the Knights of Malta? Colin?
Yeah, I think you are correct. The history is
Yeah. So I think they go back to the Crusades. They were one of the founding organizations spearheading the Crusades. So we're talking 11th century here, probably.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. So so we have knight Colin Finley with us today. Outside of that, I want to just tell a little more about his bio. There's a lot of information floating around Colin and online, and I picked out a few good ones that I wanted to talk to him about. But the theme of this program is something that, Colin said in one of his emails to me when I said, what have you been doing the last 8 years? And he says, well, look, Elizabeth, I've been working on the unknown future. Priceless. We're going to talk a little bit about the unknown future, but I have to say that he's quoted as looking for his life long in 90 countries, including the Arctic Circle and Antarctica, for the one perfect photo. And I thought that was, who is that guy, that, Henri Cartier-Bresson, that said something similar, you know, the determining moment, and there's only one.
Yes.
And yeah, decisive moment. Decisive moment, yeah, and there's only one. So another couple of things that I pulled out of various quotes from Colin Ohl all through the internet. He has been on the road for 40 years, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. But when we last talked, we were talking also with a partner, Heather McClintock, who also is a super talented artist. And a shout out to Heather if she ever hears this. We miss her.
We
miss Heather. And then I want to talk about two things. After we introduce Colin properly, I want to talk about the candid frame. And I want to talk about some of the minimalist music that he's done. And by the way, we're going to hear some of the music of Knight Finley as we're going in and out of each of the breaks here. I will say that the Hearts Roads Journal is 47 essays that Colin is working on now, because we talked a little bit about the book that's forthcoming. I want to talk a little bit about that. Having said that, you know, Colin's work, you've probably seen something that he's done, because he's been with Time and Vanity Fair and the Permanente collections. He's in permanent collections of LACMA, and he's in the collection at Annenberg, and he spoke at Annenberg. He also does a lot of TED Talks, and he's spoken at a lot of different events throughout the world, including the USC Keck School of Journalism, and then the Ford Foundation, et cetera, et cetera. We talk about Colin's work for humanity, but he also has done a lot of trademark image making, sort of a mythology type of guy who's making the mythology for such incredible visual campaigns for Grave New York, Saatchi & Saatchi, McCann, Ogilvy & Mather, Ocean Pacifics, many more. He's been an ambassador and spokesperson. This got to John. He thought this is pretty cool, Colin. Ambassador and spokesperson for Microsoft, Adobe, Western Digital, and Kingston. And not only that he developed and created the Adobe Lightroom Tour, introducing their new product to 25 photography schools. And it's kind of interesting to read this, but the tour ended after 3 months, and the schools really didn't know much about Adobe. And, you know, I think you use it all the time. I mean, I don't know any photographer that doesn't use it. Well, by the end of Colin speaking to all these photography students, basically Adobe was launched forever. And it changed the face of how they market and promoted their product, indeed. And then he's worked for Kohler, Van Cleef & Arpels. He's produced national, international ad campaigns. He's had many museum exhibitions. We'll talk a little bit about that, and award-winning books. And we mentioned that his work is in the permanent collection of a few of my favorite museums, but the list is Museum of Contemporary Art, the Southeast Museum of Photography, the Getty, LACMA, and the Santa Barbara Museum of Art. And then we're going to talk a little bit about his film, Heart's Road, and it's a soulful journey throughout his 30 years of life on the road as an artist. Not only is he the filmmaker and the still photographer, but he's also the musician on that movie, on that film. That documentary has been officially selected by 80 film festivals worldwide. It's won 60 awards, including Best Director, Best Documentary, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Score. So, and you know, I'm going to stop because there's too much to talk about, and I want to get to what Colin's actually, that main quote that is going to be the cornerstone of our talk today. He's working on the unknown future. And I'll just say that his honors include, obviously, a knighthood, but the Lucy Awards, the New York Art Directors Club, the Photo District News, Applied Arts, and the International Center of Photography, Academy of Television Arts and Sciences have all awarded Colin Finley. And so Colin is joining us, and it's pretty important work that he's been doing. So we can talk about the educational part of what he does as well. But that's just in a nutshell what we're going to be looking at when we look at this genius, Colin Finley. I want to start by asking about the candid frame. And Richard's giving us a sign. We've got to go a quick break. So maybe we'll go to break and we'll talk a little bit about the candid frame first, if that's okay, Colin. And I wanted you to tell us a little bit about how that, what the philosophy is behind that endeavor when we get back from the break. Hey, Richard.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's go to quick break. And isn't this an impressive guest?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially considering of my affinities for photography.
Yeah. So I always like to say Richard, he always loves that I have photographers on because, you know, what's so interesting is that when he was growing up, he tortured his brother in the bunk bed, the two bunk beds. His brother and he shared bunk beds because he, in the old days when chemicals were necessary for a dark room, he put a dark room right next to the bunk bed. And this brother had to stand the smell for a number of years while he worked in his dark room. Yeah, so he goes back a long way with film. Oh, anyway, don't turn that down. Back in a minute with Colin. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking with Sir Colin Finley, a Knight of Malta, and among other things, one of the world's most foremost documentary photographers and filmmakers, and he's been on the road for 30 years. But one of his projects, or there's an umbrella of projects that are under the resource name Candid Frame. There's a newsletter. There's a making photography guide, developing a personal visual workflow, YouTube channel downloads, et cetera, Candid Frame app, et cetera. And I want to know what Candid Frame is all about, Colin. Tell me.
I'm actually not sure what Candid Frame is.
Well, it says on your bio, the Candid Frame. That you have participated in some of their resources. Maybe that is the Candid Frame has had you speak on their platform. Maybe that's it. So yeah. So I think the Candid Frame is something that is it has had you speak a number of years ago, and I picked up on that. I want to apologize for that, but I want to just say to the listeners here that one of the things that we talked about in 2016. Was the Colin's coverage of war and conflict, disappearing traditions, and I want to talk about that too. The environment in the glory and devastation that we experience today, genocide, famine, religious pilgrimage, and global cultures. He's been around the globe 27 times. Is there a moment? I don't know. You know, when I was preparing for this and I was thinking about your quote, I'm working on the unknown future, Elizabeth. I got a call this morning that one of my dear friends from high school lost his daughter just five minutes before. Jeez. And and so our whole gang is sort of rallying around. But, you know, that you just don't expect that. There's certain things you just don't expect, and there's no way you can prepare. So I guess my question is, was there a moment in the 27 circumnavigations of the globe that you didn't expect something and it happened?
Gosh, that probably happens in the majority of every country I'm in multiple times.
Yeah, I bet.
Especially in terms of if I'm seeking access to something that's very politically sensitive or very charged emotionally, there's really you know, and a lot of this stuff, part of it's in the Hearts Road journals in the book, is that, you know, even some of these crazy journeys back in 97, it's like, okay, I'm going to be doing this story on an AIDS temple, 3.5-4 hours north of Bangkok. So this is where it's very difficult, but it's a Buddhist AIDS, it's a Buddhist temple. And people go there sometimes making it the last days or the last weeks or months of their life where they succumb to the AIDS virus. So it's, you know, you're going to roll 10,000 miles across the world, all of this travel, all of this journey to get to Bangkok, and then to find a fixer, an interpreter, the right guy. Then you're going to drive 3.5-4 hours to try and find this place because there's no Google Maps back then. Then I'm going to have to go in and present myself and say, is my presence here going to be a problem? Are you willing to bring me into your space? And all of this is on a risk, and you're getting on a plane, spending all this money, and there is no internet. There's no one to talk to. You're just going to have to show up, and you're just going to have to hope that you might be able to gain access and to be able to create images here. So certainly early in my career, when I think back about the number of massive gambles where it's nothing's laid out for you, you just get on a plane and it's just a, you know, proverbial saying, winging a prayer. So yeah, access to a lot of these places is really, really difficult. The Agent Orange situation also in Vietnam is also extremely, I never should have gotten access to what I got access to. It's, you know, they do a good job of keeping people out of there. That's kind of what their business is the gatekeeper. And so you're very restricted in terms of what you can create there, but somehow the right stars aligned and I was allowed inside of that space and left with images that would forever change my life.
I've always wondered what that was. What exactly is Agent Orange?
Agent Orange is the dioxin or defoliant that we saying the U.S. government deployed during the Vietnam War. So basically with all of the incursions of the North Vietnamese Army, whatnot, obviously they'd take travel. They, you know, everything would be done underneath the canopy of jungle. So you couldn't see the progression of men and movement and armies moving and mobilizing. So they basically deforested. And that's basically what this Agent Orange did, is it deforested and took all the leaves off the trees and left a scorched earth policy. And it was much easier to see men moving along, which is why they eventually dug the tunnels and they went underground and they had a very effective tunnel system, which they also incorporated into the Vietnam War. But that, of course, dioxin leaked into the, you know, groundwater. It also was sprayed on men and villages and people that were down living underneath this massive plume of Agent Orange. And of course, they would have children and the children were it's hard to say the level of the deformities are quite extreme. I mean, even one family can have four children that are deeply affected by Agent Orange, largely non-functioning. And then they have one daughter, the fifth daughter, and she's perfect, no problem at all. So you never really know. And this has just caused this long lasting issues with young children being born with some serious, serious deformities. And
when you say, this is just my own curiosity, when you say the gatekeeper, is it a literal government gatekeeper type of thing, or?
She has to answer to the government and she has to get permission for me to go in there from the government. So normally it takes, like in this situation, when I went in, she said it takes about minimum 9 months to a year to gain access to this place. And we pretty much say no to 99% of the people that apply. So the fact that you're sitting here cold asking me for access to my hospital and to my, you know, the patients and the children and the evidence locker and everything else that I've asked access to, the rest assured is not, I wouldn't think, gonna happen. So, you know, I gave her a copy of Testify. I interviewed about 4 or 5 different interpreters. I think finding the right interpreter with the right disposition, the right gentleness of soul is extremely important when that person is my only voice. So I chose, I believe the fifth woman that I spoke with and interviewed, and she was absolutely eloquent. So she spoke on my behalf and gave her a copy of my book, Testify. And that really helped with the director of the hospital to sort of get an idea of what it is that I do. And then she says, well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'll call our version of intelligence and I need your passport and, you know, whatnot. So I'll call them and they'll call us back in 15 or 20 minutes and flatly do not expect them to say yes at all. I'm pretty much absolutely guaranteed no, but if you're willing to sit here, that's fine. So.
Do you think
20 minutes later and said, yeah, access, you have it. Which was crazy to me. And then that began a really opened up a powerful set of images that pretty much brought the end to my career with that kind of work.
Amazing.
It was just too. It was really, I've been into some places where my interpreters do not tread. And as crazy as that is, I proceed alone. And my interpreter is like, I can't deal with this. I'm not going in there. I'm not going to confront this. You're on your own. And that was the case certainly in Vietnam when I was able to go in and photograph basically what is their evidence locker of the different deformities and what's happened to all of these stillborn children. And it was, you know, harrowing to say the least. Same thing in Rwanda when I went into the children's prison, my interpreter refused to go into the children's prison. He thought he'd be knifed probably or something would happen to him in there. So he sat out in the car and I had to go in there alone with a very limited French and do my best to make images inside of this children's prison who were in there for killing other children during the genocide in Rwanda in 94.
Wow.
So some of these situations get a bit deep. You know, and they challenge everything you've ever known or thought about humanity. And
that's one. I mean, there's a lot of different themes that I'm picking up on. One of them is I want to talk a little bit about the not-for-profit organization that you founded, which is called Proof Media for Social Justice. Talk a little bit about that, but also the impact that your work has had and the name that came to me in researching your career a little bit, Colin, was that you have a show, an exhibition of photography at one point in your career, which was called so succinctly and appropriately Of Consequence.
Yeah.
And I thought that's just the perfect way to talk about your work, Of Consequence. Now, maybe when Richard's giving us time, we got to go to a quick break. I would like to know more about Proof Media for Social Justice. Do you feel okay talking about that?
It's an older organization that I'm no longer affiliated with.
Okay.
So it's something that I started with the right people and just handed it off to them and let them run with it. So, you know, that's part of sometimes planting seeds and other people are the growth experts and they're the ones who are going to take this over the line. So it's something great that I was a part of being a co-founder and setting it in motion, letting other wonder people take it over and run with it. It's still around today. So it's still making a difference and still out there in this, you know, crazy, incredible world of ours.
Now, also, I'd like to hear a little bit more about Testament and some of the other materials that you've written. And I also want to talk a little bit about the Hearts Road journals and these essays that you're working on. So the written word is kind of going to be my next topic. And strangely enough, one of the things, you know, you dear listener, you can't see it, but this is a page of research that I was doing about Colin. And I circled some key things that kind of resonated with me about what people have said about him and his work. And somebody who interviewed him talked about his connection with the collective consciousness. That is a subject dear to my heart. I'd love to, I mean, as a Jungian, I'd love to hear more about that. And so would Richard, by the way, who's also a Jungian. Anyway, I just want to reintroduce Colin Finley, fantastically famous, foremost documentary photographer and filmmaker and musician, and as we're hearing, philosopher. And when we talk back from the break, I'd like to hear about Testament, a book that I looked at for our interview last in 2016. I also looked at again for this interview, and I want to hear more about Testament. So don't turn that down. Back a minute with Colin. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart speaking with an interviewee that I had on the air and was one of my favorite people to talk to in 2016. And he sort of surfaced back on the radar. And I was so interested to know, because I was following his career, was interested to know what's going on. You know, we've got Before Heaven, Heart's Road, and Testament. Would you tell us a little bit about the books, Colin?
A lot of them are just journeys into the photographic repository, the photographic reservoir of my accumulated years. And a lot of times I bring in Hearts Road journals and testify as the written essays to sort of take it to another place, if you will, that it's more than just visuals. I think, you know, as we as creatives explore that space. I mean, writing is something that that's what really got my career started at Scholastic Magazine back in the early 90s, is that I would write for Scholastic Magazine as well as I would photograph them. So it was the written word as well that got me into a lot of these places in South Africa before apartheid, and Sarajevo and Belfast, Northern Ireland, and a lot of other countries and projects I did with them. So I've always been a strong believer in that written word, because there's a lot of people, you know. That's even why I did the Hearts Road journals. It's nothing but you know, written stories. There's no photographs in it, so it's just 47 essays of the different spaces, and it works the people in a different way. You know, it works the people in a completely, in terms of how their brain interprets. I shared an early copy of the book with a women's group, ironically enough, and I was kind of confused. I actually thought, my gosh, this is a really powerful book for this group of 15 ladies to take on. And I'm really, quite frankly, impressed as hell. And I'm surprised. Because just like I got through it, and it's just, you know, there's some difficult stories in there. Some of them, you know, I hesitate to share some of the darker stories, even in the book. So I've avoided them. But there's some tough stuff in there, and it was really powerful. I went to a lecture, you know, 2 weeks later to answer the ladies' questions, and I thought I'd be talking, and the ladies just like, no, I don't want to, I just want to get straight into questions. And it was 2.5 hours of nonstop question and answer with these incredibly impassioned, inspiring women who just dove in deep and wanted to know the answers to everything. So it's really beautiful to connect with people on that. I'm not showing photographs. It's a different way of communicating, a different way of sharing what it is that I do. And that book is something like this. It's like a mock-up. So it's just all, oh yeah, you can't see it, but yeah, 160 or 80 pages of just the stories.
John's got a question for you. And I just have one reaction to the 15 ladies that got into your book so well. And I'm wondering if maybe they were picking up on the, you know, this, well, being females, the anima carries the emotional load usually. And so I'm wondering if maybe that was something was going on with that. Anyway, John, you've got a question.
We were mentioned earlier about the perfect photo.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to know, is it the kind of thing that you'll know it when you see it, Or have you, since you've been searching for the perfect photo, have you gotten any glimpses in your mind of what the perfect photo might kind of start to shape into or look like? I was just curious if you had anything to say about the perfect photo.
Mm-hmm. They are certainly elusive, but they also present themselves in something that I would, or that I refer to in a photograph, which is sacred geometry.
Is John asking about composition or content or both?
That's all of it. It's the way that the angles work inside that photograph, the dimensionality that's brought to that photograph, the way the person exists or the animal exists inside of that photograph. Hmm. Everything comes together in this extraordinary, you know, way that is, to me, enthralling. And it's something that as soon as I... It's something that you really feel that it's within a second or two, it's like, okay, this is transcended that moment. And that's what you look for, especially when I'm doing portraits, because I've done a lot of portraits of rock and roll musicians from Roger Daltrey and Bonnie Raitt and Beck. And, you know, you're looking for that. Again, that symmetry, and for me, that word is that sacred geometry that presents itself in this image. And sometimes you're working on a subconscious and you don't see it until afterwards, because I'm so lost and caught up in that specific moment that you're just on pure instinct. And then you realize later, it's like, wow, this element, this element, this element, the background, the side ground, the top, this is what's forcing it down. This is, you know, Amy Mann in this portrait. This is her body language. This is her two fingers inside of her pocket. This is the beautiful blonde piece of her hair that's fallen down in front of her eye that she's not removed and that she's left there for me. This is the kick in the bend of her knee. This is how she stands. This is who she is. And I'm not telling her how to do anything. I'm not communicating anything with her. I'm not telling her to look at me. I'm not telling her to look around. It's just like, Amy. And a lot of that beautiful intuition sometimes comes with the person. Bonnie Raitt was another similar portrait where it's like, everything is like Bonnie. It's like, oh, this is love for you to just sit here. The light, the chair, the background, everything is just perfect. It's like, wow, got it. She sits in there. 15 seconds later, you can leave. It's immediate and it resonates for me very, very powerfully. And it is a subconsciously drawn into a photograph. Then you're actually inside that photograph and I'm actually no longer behind the lens, I'm in front of the lens. And at times it feels like I even completely disappear. And it's just one spirit in front of another, creating an image that...
You've got a split, huh?
Yeah, thank you. That was great.
I have a follow-up question to that. So, Richard's saying be quiet, Elizabeth. We got to go to a quick break. So I'll ask my follow-up question after we get back from the break. Okay, don't turn that down. I'm here with Colin Finley, and I won't say the honorable or sir or knight or anything like that, even though it's a fact. Okay, don't turn that down. Back in a minute. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart, and I'm talking with one of the favorite interviewers of all. Gosh. So, Richard, we've been doing this together for 16, 17 years, and I remember Colin's interview so well back in 2016. You know, some interviews you just don't forget, and this was one of them. And when he got in touch with me, I thought, okay, it's a perfect opportunity to capture him back. And we talked a little bit about John's question as a professional photographer. You know, how do you know when you've got that perfect photo that, of course, he's been pursuing for going around the globe 27 times in 40 years. He's been pursuing it hotly and has achieved a number of them. And this is a reflection, Colin, that I have. So I'm an appraiser and I do a lot of sourcing work. So if a museum is interested in purchasing, let's say, or having their board, or they've got a benefactor who wants to purchase the work, sometimes they'll send me to the studio and I'm in charge of putting together a portfolio, not so much of the work, but of the values that the work has achieved, just because the museum wants to know market value. They also want to know how to insure it, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I get pulled in as an appraiser, and I was at this one, I mean, fairly important artist, and the San Diego Museum of Contemporary Art sent me to this studio. They wanted to know more about this artist's track record in the market. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, okay, let me, you know, investigate who he sold to, what his galleries, who his galleries are, who his representation is over the years, et cetera. And I'm going through that, and I said, well, you know, can you tell me more about the periods in which, you know, the different overs in your work, and how can I communicate something to the museum about how this particular piece they're interested in fits into the general oeuvre? And he said, no. And I said, okay, what am I going to say to the museum? I mean, I can't just come up with numbers. I have to, you know, kind of represent you as best I can. Well, I'm not saying anything. Look, would you write it? No. And he looked at me, he said, look, if I wanted to be a writer or someone that communicates with words, I would have done that. But I'm not. I'm a visual artist and I don't communicate with words. And I said, okay. Well, then I was thinking about this as I was reading up on you, Colin. And I was thinking, okay, so here's a guy that puts forward a book that's The Heart's Road's Journey, 47 essays and no illustrations and no photographs. And you're known as a photographer. So you have an ability to use both music and words and visual imagery. And most artists don't, that I've run into anyway in 30 years of doing what I do. So do you rely on the word? Do you rely on the visual image? What's predominant?
It's a deeper exploration, potentially, of the emotional content, even of my life. I haven't published them yet. I'm waiting for that unknown future, but I've also written 5 novels that are done front to back, and I've written 9 children's books, and I've done probably 35 of the illustrations as well. And those are 120 page books on, you know, in a children's book. So the words take me in a different direction and in a different place. And sometimes I think what I've done visually and now what I'm doing with how I put it all together, it is something more than just a photograph. There's something more than just the experience, you know, and what I communicated with those 15 women in that group was very powerful. I mean, one of the women said, you know, your writing is so intense, it's so deep, it's so soulful that it actually scared me. Uh-huh. I actually felt like I had to put the book down. I was too far inside of your soul. And I didn't even know if you were going to be alive by the end of the book because of what you've gone through and what you've experienced and what you've seen and what you've written about. I was so happy when I got to the end of the book and there was like this beautiful bright spark that just ignited. But, you know, that for me is a different way of communicating, because that's what I did with the USC at the Keck School, is that I didn't show the slides. I played the music. What do you see visually? And then 2 minutes later, I'm going to show you the visuals. But if you use your mind, take your mind, where are you going to go? So where are you going to go with this novel that I've written? And the novel brings in a lot of what I've done in my life. It brings in a lot of my stories, a lot of my observations, a lot of things that I've seen. So I incorporate all of that into my novels. So you're seeing a visual novel of, you know, what maybe you're not going to see. And also, you know, in terms of reaching people, it's like a photographer's coffee table book. It's like, okay, that's one dimension. You know, once you're reading a book with these journal entries, you're crossing over into a completely different space, a completely different group of people that are inspired to go on this visual journey. They'd rather fill in the blanks. They're maybe not going to sit and spend $80 on a coffee table book and flip through images. That may not be their thing. Their thing might be a little 4x5-inch book that fits in their purse or puts in their backpack, and I want to take the journey. And that's what I do. It's a lot of what I'm trying to do, really, Elizabeth, in some very deep way, is to, what is the best and most effective way to communicate with people? How do I best share the passion? How do I best share the empathy? How do I best share desire? Is it in a photograph? Is it in a children's book? Is it in music? Is it in a documentary? Is it in my stills? So these different languages are just simply that. They're different languages that I speak. I maybe happen to be sitting in the romance language category. And my photography is French, and my writing is Italian, and my illustrations are Portuguese. My novels are Spanish, you know, so it's all, and that's what I choose to do, is I push myself to those parameters and I push myself into that space of, this is what I'm going to pursue and this is what I'm going to delve into. And that's what I'm doing now.
That's a super interesting analogy. I've never heard it put that way, that, you know, that's the body of the, of a creative panoply range is simply one different type of linguistic branch on a tree.
Yeah, exactly. For me, anyway, that's really, the way I perceive it.
Yes, no, that's really interesting. You know, certain people, I just have this thing that, you know, maybe a years of schooling and a doctorate and all that, they kind of pump into your head that there's various people that have different abilities to see the world. And so there's the kinetic person, there's the visual person, there's the oral person, there's the this person, the that person, you know, that you know, it's and certainly everybody knows people that have to experience the world through their body. So they know that they're kinetic, they understand that. So, you know, we do know that. But on the same level, what you're saying is it doesn't have to be that way. It can be just, you know, another language.
It's what it feels like to me. And again, the writing came very early when I was at UC Santa Barbara. That was one of my minors. And so I started really writing so much back at UC Santa Barbara, 86, 87. And it just simply carried through into my life and just became, again, left hand, right hand. And I think it's just an important way to, I've pushed myself so far to such extremes. And this is just something sort of natural that, you know, came from that space. And these novels were a huge challenge. You know, writing a 160-page, for me, novel, and the arc of that story and the characters and everything that's created. And it was a beautiful, huge challenge. You know, and the same thing, you know, I just accept these challenges, if you will. And a lot of this came during COVID. you know, and it's just me sitting alone in the, you know, studio for 9 or 10 months. It's me and the cat. Heather, yeah. Heather was back east with her mom, the COVID hit. And, you know, so it's just, it brings a lot of different things to the surface.
Yeah.
For me, those emotions are easily tapped into with the written word.
Well, I just wanted to thank you very much, Colin, for being with us today and how fantastic it is to reconnect and talk a little bit about what you've been up to. And I thank you very much. And by the way, you know, what you're hearing, dear listener, in and out of each break are works that Colin wrote. So he is an accomplished musician, as you can hear. And now, was it you that produced the score for a documentary on Egon Schiele? Was that you, Colin?
I've just done my own music for my own documentaries.
Oh, for your own. Okay, that was maybe your colleague Brian Eno. I noticed that the circle of what I call them geniuses that you were associated with, still associated with, and the kind of music that Colin makes is very interesting and kind of minimalist and very evocative, and another part of, like he said, his many faceted languages. So I think that's super interesting. So that's the music you've been hearing throughout this hour, dear listener. Hey, Richard, let's exit the exit stage, right? And Colin, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you too, Richard. Be well. Be happy.